information is free.
The law?
There is hope.
When ignorance is converted into knowledge,
we care.
Appear to border
it shows.
The law?
The country.
You will remember nine you have seen or heard here.
Whether he went on with the diary, or whether he did not cooperate, it made no difference. The thought police would get him just the same.
The sound is what found us. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to episode 235 from MediaMonarchy.com. It's October 14th, 2011. My name is James Evan Pilato, your host and webmaster of the site and show, bringing you the real news, remixed, future crimes, assassinations, sanctions, and the well-dressed mystery. Black Plague, Born Free, and the Bridge Day News Purge. Progress, pullback, and fingerprinting on Food World Order. Threats, links, and lineups on Cyberspace War. Sketches, sacrifice, and shock value on Holy Hexes. Plus all the other alternative news, politics, conspiracies, and cover-ups. October 14th, 2011, episode 235 from MediaMonarchy.com. A damn near perfect debut single from Wild Flag, featuring ex-members of Slater Kinney and Helium. That track is called Romance. Their self-titled debut record is out on Merge Records. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. This is the 235th episode of Media Monarchy. My name is James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster of the site and show, MediaMonarchy.com, your source for alternative news, politics, conspiracies, and cover-ups. Coming to you live, as always, every Friday morning at 10 a.m. Pacific Time on the Portland Radio Authority, praradio.org. And a huge thanks to the stations that simulcast this show, ZeroPointRadio.com and RevereRadio.net. A huge thanks to them. We also want to thank our latest affiliate, KDXRadio.com, playing Media Monarchy Saturday nights, 10 o'clock Central Time. And a huge thanks to all the other alternative media outlets, websites, blogs, video channels, anything you got. As long as the satellites are in the sky, we're going to use this technology to break on through and connect with each other. All our episodes, videos, interviews, mixtapes, B-sides, radioforall.net and archive.org. And of course, those are all linked up on the main page, MediaMonarchy.com as well. Face, Space, Twitter, Tube, Tumblr, Gmail, Skype, all as Media Monarchy. You also notice the donate button. If you find independent, corporate, free, alternative media valuable, if it enriches your life, throw a few bucks. And a huge thanks to Michael in Alberta, Canada, for his generous donation. And your support helps keep this going and growing. So again, my friends, it's October 14th, 2011. We're in the People's Republic of Oregon. It was a red sky this morning. And as we glance at the breaking news, Perry aims to charge up campaign with energy-focused jobs plan. Club for Growth anti-tax group defends Herman Cain's 999 plan. Wall Street protesters arrested after park closing postponed. And I did tweet out just a few moments ago, as protesters and police clash in Denver as well as Manhattan, twitter.com/Media Monarchy. And the other top stories we see are Warren Buffett, Johnny Depp, and Lady Gaga. All that and so much more here for you, my friends, as we always keep the broken news page open so we can try and fix it on the fly for you. Let's blast through all the alternative media coming out of not only MediaMonarchy.com, but all our friends at TragedyAndHope.com, CorporateReport.com, Ground Zero, on and on. I finally got the videos up. They're on my YouTube channel at Media Monarchy. My latest appearance on the Bob Tuscan Show. On the first Wednesday of every month, I join Bob Tuscan on OracleBroadcasting.com for a rundown on some of the most important moves on the grand chessboard. This month's October appearance is, of course, dominated by the Occupy protests and foundation-funded fronts. Plus, we get into coffee, unions, the death of jobs, and so much more. Sent the audio out through the audio-only feed. But you can see the videos produced by yours truly as I figure out the maddening interface of iMovie. But those are there as well. The latest episode, it's 87th episode from NewWorldNextWeek.com, the weekly video series between myself and James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. This week's episode, Iranian Plot, Fast and Furious, Drone Virus. And of course, those stories we will touch upon in this episode 235, but just to run down the stories and the updates and the flashbacks in the background. Our first story, will U.S. exploit dubious terror case to attack Iran? We will get into in just a few minutes, as well as underwear bomber updates. Second story, Congress issues subpoena for Eric Holder and others in the Fast and Furious probe. With a link to a story just 2 weeks back, as we asked sort of the rhetorical question, could the gun-running scandal known as Fast and Furious be Obama's Watergate? And our third story from cyberspacewar.com, virus infects Creech Air Force Base systems piloting attack drones overseas. And we get into, of course, 2 weeks ago, the feds foiled the remote control terror attack on Washington, remote control Rezwan, and our related updates to this story. CIA used pirated and inaccurate software to target drone attacks. Remember, InSlaw? The government isn't afraid to steal your software if it's better than theirs. Military says computer virus wasn't directed at drones, and I believe Danger Room quotes them as saying it's merely a nuisance. I've also been providing a link to my New World Next Week backup mirror on archive.org, as we also have them on Blip and YouTube and CorbettReport.com server. So again, just trying to build out the redundancy. If one goes down, the three others will be there, and you should do the same with all your alternative media and always copy and back things up. Which brings us to episode 203 from Corbett Report. Philosophy of freedom, natural law. What is the rule of law? On what basis do we institute laws, and why should we obey them? Are laws for the protection of inalienable rights? And if so, how do we derive our knowledge of those rights? Are governments necessary for the enforcement of the laws? Episode 203 gets into that and so much more in search of natural law. And we also have linked up, of course, all the other amazing audio, video, interview, and materials coming from CorbettReport.com, an appearance on Russia Today and the American Spring, or is it autumn, and is it political theater or transformative protest? A great little travelogue piece of some random Japanese jazz that James captured on the streets, which connects us right back to the Fukushima crisis that is ongoing. Insiders reveal Fukushima secrets, Afghanistan, 10 years of war, and meet InQtel, the CIA's venture capital firm. We also have latest interviews with Bob Chapman, Christopher Porter, Brad Morrison, Dr. David Halpin, and Rick Rosoff. All that and so much more from CorbettReport.com. And now our friends in the Tragedy and Hope community and the fantastic PeaceRevolution.org podcast. Episode 41 is part one of the ultimate history lesson. And what is that? That is A Weekend with John Taylor Gatto, a multi-DVD interview project currently in post-production, 5+ hours of interview footage. There are donate buttons and the links provided here for you on my posting of episode 41 from PeaceRevolution.org and TragedyAndHope.com. And I believe James Corbett mentioned on a recent episode that those of us in the producers' side of the Tragedy and Hope community, I don't want to get too bogged down in shop talk here, but as it becomes closer and comes closer, there'll be widgets on all our pages so you can donate to help and to get this multi-DVD interview project. I believe there may also be a Blu-ray option as well. So this episode 41, needless to say, my friends, is part one of this massive ultimate history lesson with John Taylor Gatto. So it's hour one, and all the massive amount of documentation and links are provided. That, I think, is one of the things that I think brings kind of like-minded independent producers together, is, you know, admiring in other folks what you try and do yourself. I love that they source and document all their stuff in a nice little bibliograph kind of form. Now, one guy who doesn't do that is my man Clyde Lewis of groundzeromedia.org. We always post up his latest articles and links to the podcast feeds weeknights, 5 nights a week, 9 to midnight here in Portland, Oregon on KXL 101.1 FM. We also provide their Twitter links at Clyde Lewis and at KXL News. Latest articles, Cyber Prophet, as in to tell the future. Preparing for the app-pocalypse. The cake is a lie, employing the unitary executive policy, tales from the revolutionary war. I pray the Lord my soul to creep, and werewolf their wolf. All that, and again, so much more from Clyde Lewis and groundzeromedia.org. I discovered he also is putting up little sort of behind the scenes and sneak preview videos, short videos on a YouTube channel, and that link is provided. I believe the channel name is Harry Scary 23. GroundZeroMedia.org, Cyber Prophet, Soul to Creep, all that, and so very much more, my friends. That's a quick blast through all the alternative media. Again, that is, as I say, I'm proud enough and happy enough to be involved with and connected to in some way, shape, or form. And again, if you find this media valuable, please donate some type of resource, economic or spiritual or metaphorical or what have you. We now turn into, or should I say we turn to, we don't want to turn into something. Let's get into our biggest news stories of the past week that are, so, you know, and again, so interesting as you see massive stories that get huge coverage, and as the wheels start to come off, oh, it starts to disappear from the news, and we'll have to talk about that new iPhone that everybody's lining up for, because who wants to hear about U.S. preparing more sanctions against Iran over Saudi murder plot? And as we discuss this story again on the latest episode of NewWorldNextWeek.com, will the U.S. exploit this latest dubious terror case to essentially kickstart World War III? And I read this piece from Kurt Nimmo on the New World Next Week episode, so I won't rehash that, if only to mention and remind you, and we do have a clip to get further into this story as it falls apart, that this whole assassination plot was suggested by our own agents, as it always goes. So we have sources to IBTimes.com, DemocracyNow.org, Channel6NewsOnline.com, CNN, BBC, YouTube, Mother Jones, and our updates from InfoWars, Blacklisted News, Anti-War, and again, CNN, as the wheels come off the phony Iran terror plot, fake, 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 and some analysts are actually even skeptical of this alleged Iranian plot. So, U.S. preparing more sanctions over Iran over this Saudi murder plot, and again, we ask the question, will the U.S. exploit this latest dubious terror case?
There's a new war of words between Tehran and Washington, with the U.S. Justice Department accusing elements of the Iranian government of conspiring to assassinate a Saudi diplomat. Two Iranian men have been charged over what the FBI describes as a foiled plot to hire members of a Mexican drug cartel to murder the Saudi ambassador to the U.S. North America correspondent Craig McMurtry reports.
They filed in to announce the arrest in a case that reads like a Hollywood script, a $1.5 million international conspiracy hatched in three countries to murder a high-ranking diplomat on U.S. soil. At the center of it, according to prosecutors, Iranian-American Mansour Ababsiar.
A well-funded and pernicious plot. The details of that murder plot are chilling, to say the least.
The FBI says the Saudi ambassador was the target. Other U.S. officials say there were also plans to bomb the Saudi and Israeli embassies. It's alleged that in May, the 56-year-old approached someone he thought was connected to one of Mexico's most notorious drug cartels to arrange the killing. In fact, Abab Siar was talking to an informant for the U.S. federal government.
It states that we live in a world where borders and boundaries are increasingly irrelevant.
He was arrested once $100,000 was wired to an account as a down payment for the most explosive charge is that elements of the Iranian government were behind the plot.
That this conspiracy was conceived, was sponsored, and was directed from Iran.
Washington alleges that a co-conspirator, a man called Gholam Shakuri, is a member of the Quds Force, an elite division in Iran's Revolutionary Guard.
This kind of action, which violates international norms, must be ended.
Tehran has flatly dismissed the accusation as U.S. propaganda.
Prosecutors say Abab Siar didn't care about mass casualties when discussing bombing a fictional Washington restaurant, telling the informant, no problem, no big deal.
According to prosecutors, he later confessed, though his lawyer says he'll be pleading not guilty. The U.S. president was briefed on the plot back in June, and the administration has already announced new sanctions on leaders of Iran's Revolutionary Guard. Craig McMurtry, ABC News, Washington.
I negotiated with them for nearly 2 years over Afghanistan, Al-Qaeda, and Iraq. So I've had a lot of up-close, detailed conversations with them. I've seen their national security strategy up close and talked to them about it for hours and hours and hours on end. This, what we've seen unfold, makes no sense in terms of Iran's national security strategy. There's no benefit, there's no payoff from them pursuing this kind of hit against Al-Zubair, and it runs contrary to their entire national security strategy. So we have a plot with no rationale.
Does that make the allegations implausible, or are the allegations plausibly accusing the Iranians of something stupid?
Well, you know, any allegation is plausible, but I also served in the Bush administration in the lead-up to the Iraq War, where I saw a lot of allegations come through paid informants like Ahmed Chalabi, and I raised questions about them inside the Bush administration, and everyone said, oh, well, we know the nature of Saddam Hussein's regime, so even if it's stupid, they're so bloodthirsty, they would probably do it anyway. Well, here the questions really need to be asked again, and this time taken really seriously, because this would be such a significant departure for the Iranian government to be involved in something like this. It really warrants our toughest questions in scrutiny.
Well, let me ask you about one, I don't know if it's a parallel or not, but you say this makes no sense given their strategy. You think about the bombings in Buenos Aires back in 1994. 85 people killed. The Argentinian government blamed the Iranians for putting Hezbollah up to the job. It didn't make a lot of sense either, I guess, in some sense. Could this be the same kind of thinking that was behind that attack?
Well, that was a very specific, you know, to the extent that there was the linkage is clear, it was specifically tied to, according to Hezbollah, for the Israeli hit on the Hezbollah leader the year before. So there was a linkage to something that had happened. There's no linkage here to anything that had happened. For the Iranians, they've had a rivalry with the Saudis for a long time. In fact, between 1980 and 1988, during the Iran-Iraq War, the Iranians saw the Saudis as completely financing and paying for Iraq's war on Iran that cost 300,000 Iranians their lives. During that entire time, they didn't hurt a single Saudi citizen anywhere in the world. So the idea that today, that because they're not getting along, somehow the Iranians are going to go and bomb the embassy or a restaurant where Al-Zubair is, it really makes no sense. And what it does is it actually distracts us from the reality and the strength of Iran's national security strategy, which is doing a good job for Iran, both in terms of protecting Iran and in terms of turning the balance of power in the Middle East very much in Iran's favor and very much against the United States. We're missing the real story here, which is that the balance of power in the Middle East is turning toward Iran and away from us.
Well, there you have it. First part of that clip just breaking down the official story, and the second, an appearance on CNN, an analyst, skeptical to say the very least. So again, my friends, we go into this on the latest episode of NewWorldNextWeek.com. We do have a couple of other related geopolitical updates from the Washington Post. The Gilad Shalit prisoner exchange deal reached with Hamas, says Netanyahu. And from AllGov.com, breaking down the story, one Israeli soldier equals 1,000 Hamas fighters. An easy transition to what was initially a bombshell, as Paul Joseph Watson called it. A shocking development in the trial of the accused underwear bomber Umar Farouk Abdul Muttalab. Delta Flight 253 eyewitness Kurt Haskell was called by Abdul Muttalab as a witness for the defense, a move that could have blown the whole case wide open. So here is Kurt Haskell on the InfoWars Nightly News discussing the situation before the dramatic reversal.
2 days before this, I was in court watching the prospective jurors get questioned, and how this works, the judge asked each juror some questions, and then the prosecutor asked some questions, and then the defense attorney. And, you know, I kept seeing the same questions come up from the judge and from standby attorney Chambers for the defense. And they were basically two questions, slightly varied, but the first one was, you think after you hear all the evidence, you'll be able to determine whether the defendant actually possessed a bomb or an explosive device? And the second question that was repeated often was, do you realize that the media doesn't always tell the truth? So I thought those two questions were pretty telling to me. You know, and as I'm sitting there with all these members of the press thinking they're going to report these in their articles, I even talked to two reporters, one from Reuters and one from CNN, saying, you know, are you guys catching on to what's going on here, that what I've been telling you for 2 years now is actually true? And both of them kind of shook their heads agreeing with me. But do we have those statements or those questions or any significance in any media story from that day? Not at all. The only place that even appeared was in a continuing blog the Free Press had that day on freep.com, and it was just a little blurb. They had someone at the courthouse giving continual updates, and what it said was the media is really taking a beating here today or something like that. The only place this was even scratched upon at all, because obviously, you know, if the media reports that these questions keep coming up, the next question is why? And the answer is very obvious. It's what I've been saying all along. Umar was placed on this plane intentionally by an undercover U.S. intelligence agent with a defective bomb. That's the real story. It's the story the press is trying very hard to cover up, and it doesn't want it to get out. It's too explosive. Now, that being said, Umar had a couple of outbursts at the hearing on October 4th saying that the U.S. is a cancer, and I forget exactly. It's on my blog if you want to see the exact words.
He was saying that Zarqawi wasn't dead and the rest of it.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Anwar al-Awlaki isn't dead. He's alive, something like that. And an AP reporter asked me about that after the hearing. What he says, what do you make out of these outbursts? And I said, well, you know, I saw Umar before we boarded. He didn't make a peep. I saw him when he lit his fake bomb on the plane, and his crotch was burning, and he didn't make a sound. And I've seen him here several times in court, and he's always quiet and, you know, doesn't say much, and this is totally out of character. So what the AP reported was, Haskell says this is out of character for Umar. You know, when he lit his bomb, he didn't make a peep. Well, I read that article and it left out two important things that I thought. One, that I saw him before we boarded, and two, that I said he lit a fake bomb. So you can see how the media was twisting my statements back on Tuesday.
Yeah, it's turning them into false statements, but you told me today on the radio the AP reporter wasn't done there. I mean, he wants to continue to misrepresent what you're saying.
Right. And after this bombshell on Thursday, where Umar indicated in court that he's calling me as his only witness, I got a call from the same reporter, Ed White, of the AP, and you can see his name attached to many of these articles. And I said, look, Ed, before I talk to you again, you know, I read your article Tuesday. I'm not very happy with it. You left out two important details, and I said, I'm only going to agree to talk to you if you put in your article word for word what I say and don't twist it around. Well, this time he put in that I gave him a wild story or something like that, a wild theory on what happened. So based on that, I'm now done with the mainstream media, with a couple very small exceptions, one being Fox News and one being another reporter named Vicky Thomas. I'm not sure who she's with, but she's reported fairly on what I've indicated. So that's going to be about it for the mainstream media. For me, I'm finished with them. They have an agenda here, especially with the trial starting and with me testifying on behalf of the defense. I'm sure they'd love to twist my words around to paint me some lunatic. It's not going to happen. I'm not talking to them anymore. So, but again, you know, two things are happening with the media. They're not reporting on this, or they're reporting inaccurately, leaving out things or twisting things around. We can see a clear agenda here by the media.
After initially vowing to plead innocent and call Kurt Haskell, the man who saw him being aided onto Delta Flight 253 by a well-dressed man as defense witness, alleged underwear bomber Umar Farouk Abdulmutallab has changed his mind and admitted all eight charges against him, thereby protecting accomplices involved in the plot. In the space of a few days, Abdulmutallab completely reversed his decision to defend himself, rather, and made no proper statement in court, instead simply reeling off a list of cliched extremist statements. Mutalab's reversal now means that Haskell's contention that the plot was, as in almost every other terror case made public, a product of government entrapment, and that the U.S. intelligence establishment was involved in the aborted attack, which will now remain buried, at least for the time being. Dramatic reversal as Mutalab pleads guilty, shields government complicity, and keeps the well-dressed man a mystery. And again, we provide, as we do in all of our posts, we try and provide you with the extra subtext and context for you to go read other sources, left, right, up, down, mainstream, independent. Our next piece from allgov.com is, again, one that we've covered in many ways, shapes, and forms, as it's become one of the main pieces of predictive programming in our culture. And there will always be the obligatory reference to the book and film Minority Report. Homeland Security testing pre-crime detection technology. The Department of Homeland Security has been secretly working on technologies that can tip off law enforcement about those planning to commit a crime. Part profiling, part advanced mathematics, the future attribute screening technology, FAST, is described as a pre-crime system, quote-unquote, by Homeland Security. The program uses ethnicity, gender, breathing, eye tracking, and heart rate to formulate a system for spotting criminals before they strike. According to the official description, the prototype contains, quote, a suite of real-time, non-invasive sensor technologies to detect cues indicative of malintent, the intent or desire to cause harm. And you can read that in the PDF link provided. However, what we don't have is the classified DHS document reportedly indicated that the controversial idea is already being tested on some members of the public voluntarily, and if the technology proves reliable, the government might try using it at airport checkpoints, border crossing, seaports, or major sporting events. More on this latest pre-crime story from CNET. And we'll wrap up this episode with a return to future crimes. But for now, my friends, we turn to the 1013 News Purge. We've got our eyes straight on you. Taking that line from our opening track from Wild Flag. And we begin this news purge of headlines with our BioWars EnviroHealth stories, where there was a 5.3 earthquake off the Oregon coast just a couple of days ago. We have stories from Examiner.com as well as the IntelHub.com. Strong quake hits off coast. No damage reported. What I didn't figure out is whether there were multiple earthquakes, because I feel like as I was doing just a little cursory glancing around that I saw different magnitude listings. 5.3 or 5.1 or perhaps even higher. And I feel like before I've seen these stories, there have been a few times where I wonder, It felt like the ground shook. But it is a city, and everybody's always making racket and trucks and all that crap. That's not to say I haven't discussed the ifs and whens of a massive Pacific Northwest quake. Which takes us all the way back to 3/11. Our one update on the nuclear nightmare and Fukushima. In one single Tokyo ward, there are 13 schools that all have radiation above the safety standards. And that story is from Energy News, ENENews.com, and so is this one, which brings us back to our coast. As the Southern California nuclear plant is a cancer factory that generates electricity. 8.5 million people live within 50 miles of the San Onofre plant. O-N-O-F-R-E. I may be mispronouncing that. But from here to there to all around, and we've seen nuclear catastrophes over this past year somehow related to, in a way, a cyberspace war, a Stuxnet, a I-9-11. But our other BioWars EnviroHealth updates. From naturalnews.com, the FDA approves dangerous new antidepressant drug for dogs, and it's called Reconcile for separation anxiety. But it is a serotonin reuptake inhibitor. It's from the same class of drugs as Prozac and others. And now you're going to have dogs on that walking around? And related in just only the most bizarre ways, and those I think are the things as bizarre and twisted as this is, these are the things that I think kind of typify what media monarchy is, and that is that kind of all around, all the time media and memes that float around that I see and that I tap into and that I am connected to in some way and try and put together here in some kind of cogent form for you. From theintelhub.com, top CDC official who worked in bioterrorism and emergency response arrested on child molestation and bestiality charges. Kimberly Lindsay, deputy director for the CDC, accused of child molestation involving a six-year-old child and bestiality for two sexual incidents supposedly involving a pet. More on this story from ABC News. With links to the CDC and ZeroHedge.com. And these are the people that are running our labs, where diseases are fought, yes, but they're also created. And they're also recreated. And sometimes during a drill or an accidental test, or some other event, they get out. And we've seen it before. And we have updates on Ivans and anthrax in just a few minutes. But bearing in mind what we just heard, and that was just the latest example of people who put themselves in positions of power to be able to abuse that power, whatever their trip is. Bearing that story in mind, we close out our BioWars EnviroHealth updates with this disturbing one, I believe, from Newsy. As the Black Plague genome has now almost been entirely reconstructed.
Scientists have made quite the discovery after examining some ancient teeth. They looked at the remains from victims of the Black Plague buried in London. The scientists are the first in history to reconstruct the genome of an ancient disease using only skeletal remains. When the Black Plague swept through Europe during the 14th century, it killed roughly half of the population. And CNN reports the recently constructed genome is not so genetically different from the strains of the plague still around today. The network interviewed the author of the study, who says, "They're almost identical. Even a mother and a child show more genetic differences than the ancient Black Death strain and the modern plague strain." Last year, anthropologists at Johann Gutenberg University, Mainz, confirmed the Black Plague was caused by Yersinia pestis, a disease that kills an estimated 2,000 people each year. But the genetic similarities unearthed in the study don't explain why the death toll is so low now. NPR talked with a biological anthropologist on the research team who notes, "There is no smoking gun, so to speak, to say, aha, we found the one mutation which caused this tremendous virulence and now we know why it killed 50 million people." We don't see that. The researchers suggested other factors beyond genetics to explain why the Black Death was so fatal. The New York Times reported the deadliness of the Black Death may reflect the condition of its medieval victims. The climate was cooling, heavy rains rotted out crops and caused famine, and the Hundred Years' War began in 1337. People were probably already suffering from malnutrition and other diseases when the plague arrived like the fourth horseman of the apocalypse. It's likely modern antibiotics could have severely limited the death toll of the plague. Still, John Hatcher says society is now much more interconnected than it was in the past. That could mean bad news in the event of a similar epidemic.
Paradoxically, society was able to cope much better in the 14th century with deaths on this horrendous scale than we would be able to cope today. And this is primarily because people were, to a degree, self-sufficient and independent, whereas today we have such complex interconnections that deaths on anything like that scale would cause complete chaos.
Thomas Gilbert is one scientist who previously tried to find plague DNA from Black Death victims. He wasn't able to do so, but in an interview with NPR, he says this new research looks very convincing. He says the insights that come from these studies will be of interest not only from a historical perspective, but also to help scientists understand how deadly epidemics have emerged in the past so they can get ready for what might come in the future. According to CNN, the new research suggests the Black Plague was the first time Yersinia pestis has infected humans. It's possible an earlier plague of Justinian in 541 AD was caused by a different pathogen. It's also possible it could have been caused by an extinct strain of Yersinia pestis.
So reconstructing the Black Plague, they've reconstructed the 1918 flu, and these are the things that will give us our right-at-your-door contagion, the stand, whatever bit of predictive programming most suits the moment. Continuing down the 1013 news purge, we've got our eyes straight on you. We hit our drug war updates as, surprise, surprise, Obama is escalating the attack on legal marijuana. The Obama administration's top prosecutors in California are implementing a joint ha-ha campaign to go after the state's biggest medical marijuana operations, claiming businesses are flouting the law and making an illegal profit. More on this story from the Los Angeles Times. Federal crackdown on medical pot sales reflects a shift in policy. And Obama DOJ ratchets up war against medical marijuana from StopTheDrugWar.com. And a related bit from Natural News. PBS documentary highlights marijuana's amazing ability to treat disease. And there's a 10-minute teaser, but we just go ahead and link you to the entire documentary, Clearing the Smoke, The Science of Cannabis. It's available on YouTube in its entirety. And let's see if we can make all these dots kind of connect with our last drug war update from the BBC. Opium production in Afghanistan rose by an estimated 61% this year compared with 2010, according to a United Nations report. The increase has been attributed to rising opium prices that have driven farmers to expand cultivation of the illicit opium poppy by 7% in 2011. Last year, opium production halved largely due to a plant infection, which drastically reduced yields. Afghanistan produces 90% of the world's opium, the main ingredient of heroin. Analysts say that revenue from the drug has helped fund the... We'll just stop right there. You fill in the blank. With another easy transition to our EconoCrash updates, as hedge fund billionaire Raj Rajaratnam, I believe, has gotten an 11-year sentence in his insider trading case, one of the largest insider trading cases in history that we know about. connected, of course, and involving Goldman and Google and Hilton and Intel, and again, the Justice Department. And these are the ones that we know about. EndOfTheAmericanDream.com notes that even the CEOs on Obama's jobs creation panel are also shipping jobs out of the U.S. And those are some of the folks like Ursula Burns of Xerox, or Kenneth Chenow of American Express, or Antonio Perez of Eastman Kodak, or Boeing, or GE, or on and on and on. Our last EconoCrash note, financial giants put New York cops on their payroll. This comes from Cryptogon.com, sourcing back to Counterpunch, noting that these officers are indemnified by the taxpayer, not the corporation, even though they're essentially being hired as private bodyguards for banksters. And yes, we'll get to our Occupy updates in just a few moments. But first, our history mystery notes, and yes, I mentioned it just a moment ago, and we've got stories from AllGov and the New York Times. Scientist analysis disputes FBI closing of anthrax case. Scientists dispute the FBI closing of the Ivins case. And they are presenting evidence that the case should not have been closed. And again, we, like I said, there's more from PBS and from AllGov and from the GAO and again the DOJ and the FBI. And in a related way, we ask the question, is Fort Detrick toxic to soldiers and their families? And we have noted in the past on our EnviroHealth updates that there is a huge cancer cluster in Frederick, Maryland, I believe connected to Fort Detrick. That's somewhere back in the archives. Our last history mystery note veers away from Fort Detrick in Frederick, Maryland, and goes to Canada, where mass graves have been discovered at a closed Mohawk Institute residential school. And again, Cryptogon.com has the goods on that. We're blasting through the 1013 News Purge, a list of headlines that, again, we try and just lay out the path, throw out the crumbs, and try and hopefully make sense of it all. Our media memes, Quickster quickly killed by Netflix. Same way I found out about the launch of Quickster was by an early Monday morning email from Reed Hastings, the CEO of Netflix. But because of customer backlash, they're not going to split off the DVDs into a separate company. And again, we'll remind you, now more than ever, navigating Netflix.com. Our other media meme notes, Hillary Swank and Jean-Claude Van Damme celebrate the birthday of a Chechen warlord. Fall McCartney walks down the aisle for the third time. And Mikey Welsh, former Weezer bassist, played on the Green Album, was behind the hit Hashpipe, has died at the age of 40, and I believe the update is that it is some type of overdose. And our other media meme obituary note, Roger Williams, pianist known for sentimental songs, dies at the age of 87, and we provide for you, and I love these, I've noted it before, some of my favorite channels on YouTube are the ones who show you the playing of the vinyl. Roger Williams, Born Free. Straight off the vinyl, that's Roger Williams, Born Free. Roger Williams, noted for sentimental songs, has died at the age of 87, and that was our nice little break there as we get back into the gory details on the News Purge as we reach our murder and mayhem updates. 8 killed in shooting at Seal Beach, California hair salon.
The death toll in Wednesday's salon shooting has gone up from 6 to 8, with a 9th person critically injured. The shooting happened at about 1:30 Wednesday afternoon in Seal Beach, California, just south of Los Angeles.
One of the girls that works in the salon, her ex-husband came in, obviously very distraught. I don't know what the problems were as of recent, but he's just took everybody.
Police say the gunman then got into a car and drove away. He was stopped by officers about a half mile from the scene and surrendered without incident. It's just the second homicide for the small community in the past 4 years.
The city of Seal Beach, this could be one of our greatest tragedies. And it has had a tremendous effect on our small community.
The salon was busy at the time of the shooting, and police say they discovered bodies scattered throughout. They're still struggling to determine the motive, and it's unclear what type of weapon was used or if the shooter used more than one. Nicole Grether, The Associated Press.
The mass murder contagion that we have speculated about for years now seems to only be increasing, as, of course, the rug is being pulled out from Middle America on purpose in part of the grand design. But I digress. We're continuing through the murder and mayhem. Austin Powers random task actor, now suspected in prison killing. Joseph Heungmin Son, who played Dr. Evil's odd job, inspired from the James Bond films, henchman random task in the original Austin Powers movie, before he was sentenced to life in prison for torturing a woman, is now under investigation for the death of his cellmate. From the Los Angeles Times, remains of rainbow gathering attendee from California possibly found, and perhaps a little bit of perspective, Honduras has the world's worst murder rate. But back here in the States, we see, again, the copycat effect due to sinister forces or just the clustering. I can't say. I just put it on the record and note that a second tourist has died after a Manhattan helicopter crash. 19 held in an explosives probe launched after the Norway killings, connected possibly to the sale of illegal explosives, I guess connected to Breivik and his bombs on the island that had massive amounts of bombs going off and massive amounts of shootings going off and eyewitnesses who said there's more than one gunman. But all that stuff's going away. However, maybe in this probe of 19 with explosives, we'll find something. But again, we see typically the well-dressed man remains a mystery. Closing out our murder and mayhem updates, authorities launch a new effort to identify the victims of John Wayne Gacy.
They were murdered by one of America's most notorious serial killers. No one knew their names, but investigators hope that is about to change.
These are 8 individuals who right now are nothing more than just forgotten people that were murdered by one of the most evil persons ever to walk the earth.
More than 30 years after serial killer John Wayne Gacy murdered 33 young men in Chicago, detectives are hoping to answer one last question. Who exactly were these victims? They've secretly exhumed bones of 8 young men who were never identified. They're taking DNA samples and asking anyone whose loved ones disappeared in the 1970s to come forward.
We believe with the type of technology we have and the work that's been done, we can bring the closure to them and to their families so that they are not forever forgotten.
Gacy was convicted of murdering 33 young men and was executed in 1994. He's remembered as one of history's most bizarre killers. He worked as an amateur clown and often posed as a police officer to lure his victims to a Chicago-area home for sex. He stabbed one and strangled the others between 1972 and 1978. Most were buried in a crawl space under his home. 4 others were dumped in the river. Nicole Grether, The Associated Press.
33 indeed. Continuing the 1013 News Purge, we've got our eyes straight on you. We reach our police state updates. And I suppose before we get into those posted to MediaMonarchy.com, we glance at the breaking news again on this October 14th, 2011 morning in the People's Republic of Oregon. Despite pressure, anti-Wall Street movement stands ground. Police move into Wall Street protest area, take down tents, says park is closed. That's from the Washington Post. From Bloomberg, Wall Street protesters arrested after park closing postponed. But then over to Denver. Denver police dismantle protest site. So again, as we noted at the top of the show on twitter.com/MediaMonarchy, noting the spike in activity in the Empire State as well as Denver. But I digress. Let's get back to our police state updates. I was going to go in some New World Airport, Denver underground military bases, Operation Mountain Guardian and all that, but I won't do it. An important piece that actually is a couple of weeks old, but I found it important when I was asking myself the question, and it keeps coming up. Who started this Occupy Wall Street thing? I think it sources back to other places, but I have the link to washingtonsblog.com on the long road to hashtag Occupy Wall Street and the origins of the 99% movement. How anonymous, amped status, the New York General Assembly, U.S. Day of Rage, Adbusters, and thousands of individual actions led to the occupation of Liberty Park and the birth of a movement. There you have it. And again, we go over this quite a bit on my latest appearance on the Bob Tuscan Show. All those videos are now up on youtube.com/MediaMonarchy. But continuing our Occupy coverage, a note from Natural News that reminded me, zombie training? Occupy Atlanta turns into collective hypnosis, one voice weirdness. And this story talks about in the organizing how the leaders put out the demands and the crowd repeats them back. And I think I probably recorded some of that here at Occupy Portland, where all they were saying was, you know, don't cross in front of the fire department garage doors, which is a pretty smart idea. And they did that. They were saying it, and there was the call and response. And I had forgotten about that. I should probably have some of that recorded. So we'll see if this keeps rising and if this keeps becoming a theme and meme. We'll put it out there for you guys to hear. But furthermore, from the IntelHub.com, March on Millionaires' Homes, actually organized by Obama-supporting unions. And speaking of the IntelHub.com, and speaking of my recent appearance on the Bob Tuscan Show on Oracle Broadcasting, a nice video on YouTube that notes, Occupy Gainesville is here to stay.
I can't be there, so this is the way I can be part of it.
Brooklyn native and current Gainesville resident Maggie Tingle says she's been fighting.
I'm a woman who has to get food stamps, has no medical coverage, has no insurance, and works part-time, and my hours are constantly being cut.
Tingle is one of hundreds who gathered in Gainesville tonight.
Join us and make your voices heard.
Coming from all walks of life. Saying,
we're mad as hell, and we're not going to take it anymore.
The growing group has relocated to the front of City Hall, making it official. Gainesville's movement has begun. And this is just the planning stages of Occupy Gainesville, set to begin on October 12th and mimic New York's three-week-old protest group.
We will be occupying the central part of the city in order to raise awareness for these very important issues.
But like Wall Street's movement, Occupy Gainesville doesn't have a clear focus.
The working committees is a way to break it down into more manageable groups to be able to come to a consensus and come up with solutions.
Exercise your right to peaceably assemble. Occupy public space.
As Occupy Gainesville works towards an identity, from this gathering, one thing is certain. It's not just hippies and peace activists.
There's grandparents, there's parents, there's widows, there's workers, there's lawyers, there's working class people, there's people without jobs, there's students.
And on their quest for change, these people say they're in it for the long haul.
Just understand, it's not a quick fix, but just know that there's a lot more people like me.
And there's also Bob Tuscan in that clip, paraphrasing the, I was going to say late great, but he's a fictional character, Howard Beale from Network, and we're mad as hell and we're not going to take it anymore. Again, that video is on theintelhub.com, and the one update that we have posted, New York officials delay protesters' park cleanup, as again, we were just reading some of the latest headlines for you within the last half hour or so related to the spike in activity at Occupy Denver and Occupy Wall Street. However, around the world and our other police state updates, the Positive ID Corporation receives a Verichip order for use with the Israeli military. That's a press release over on MarketWatch.com. And an historic surge exercises airlift crisis contingency response October 17th through the 20th. That is an internal memo, again, that theintelhub.com has provided. Exactly what that gets into, I haven't even broken it down. But we note from time to time, and we used to cover it all the time, although it can become its own full-time activity, just watching all the drills and war games and exercises, which are used for a number of reasons. Our last police state note goes to the New York Times in the science section as the government aims to build a data eye in the sky. So Skynet, Terminator, pre-crime, Minority Report, it's all been shoved down our throat. And I was just hearing it recently from where I'm not sure, it was probably from James Corbett talking about how so much science fiction has been used to instill that predictive programming in people like H.G. Wells with all their intelligence and elite connections, telling you what's going to go down, not just writing you little fun stories. Last couple notes on the 1013 News Purge. War whores, as the military confirms a rocket-propelled grenade downed that chopper in Afghanistan that allegedly killed 38, that allegedly cleaned out the rest of the SEAL Team 6, that allegedly was involved in the assassination of the man that was allegedly Osama bin Laden, where his body was allegedly dumped at sea, and there were allegedly photos that they were allegedly going to show us. You get the idea. Obama assassinates now two Americans that we know of, and due process, quote-unquote, has now just turned into an historical concept. So, as we know, the rising opium in Afghanistan, troop pullout from Afghanistan, question mark, not for the CIA and for special operations, because drugs fund Wall Street, and the old boys and the OSS and the CIA are all intimately connected. Occupy that. Finally, on this news purge, West Virginia worry from Pixic.com. West Virginia man arrested after video recording the cops. And he has put that video up on YouTube and has just simply called it Rodney King. In another case of being arrested for recording cops breaking their own laws that they're supposed to be enforcing. But they're just policy enforcement. Police. Suit against Parkersburg, West Virginia police settled. That's their third one this year for police brutality. Good job. And finally, thankfully, the one day of the year that I can count on there being positive news about not only my home state, but my very hometown of Fayetteville, West Virginia. I've probably mentioned this in the past. Hell, I've probably played a clip at some point in the past. But the third Saturday in October is something that's called Bridge Day on the New River Gorge Bridge in my hometown. So if you take out a quarter, if you're here in the North American Union, you know there's all the state quarters. Find a West Virginia quarter and flip it over and check it out, and that bridge is on the West Virginia quarter. That's the New River Gorge Bridge in my hometown. It was the world's largest single-arch steel bridge. And it's over the New River because it was the New River that wasn't the Nile River. Fayette County prepares for Bridge Day, the area's largest one-day festival.
The one-day event is expected to bring up to 250,000 visitors into southern West Virginia. And today, organizers were doing some last-minute preparations in Fayette County. Our Marilee McAuliffe has more on the highly anticipated event.
It's kind of neat for 6 hours that you get to showcase a beautiful state.
A year's worth of planning for just one day. Bridge Day is a long-time tradition in Fayette County. It's also the largest one-day event in the state.
We've got base jumpers and rappellers coming from all over the United States as well as several countries, so we're very excited about that.
This event doesn't take place overnight. Preparation begins months in advance. Those with the Fayette County Sheriff's Department say planning for Bridge Day begins as soon as one ends.
The day after Bridge Day, we have our, I guess you would call it, our follow-up meeting to see how Bridge Day went for that year. What do we need to do? What do we need to change to make it better?
They're not the only ones spending months planning for the event. Kay Crossan came all the way from Mississippi with her sisters to get in on the action.
We've got to do this. So we've been saving our money and buying the right clothes and emailing. It's been so funny, the emails saying, do you have a base layer and a middle layer and an outer layer and all the good long underwear?
A lot of preparation goes into Bridge Day with all the vendors and booths being set up, but organizers say what folks look forward to the most are the jumpers.
3, 2, 1, go!
And base jumpers are the show. They do cartwheels. They'll do somersaults. They'll do dramatic dress-ups for the jumping. So there's always something to see.
Reporting in Fayette County, I'm Marilee McAuliffe.
Some new features at this year's event include a shuttle that will take you down into the gorge where you can get a great look at the bridge from below. The cost to travel that shuttle is just $20.
Bridge Day. The New River Gorge Bridge was born in 1977, just like me. And again, it's the third Saturday in October. It's a huge bridge. You could fit a Statue of Liberty underneath it. It goes over the New River, which is home to world-class whitewater rafting, the New River and the Gauley River. We'll take that little happy note. We'll take those little happy notes anywhere we can get them. And again, the main bit is that people parachute jump off of the bridge, base jumping. That's all I'll say about it now. We are into hour number 2 of episode 235 from MediaMonarchy.com. It's October 14th, 2011, and my name is James Evan Pilato, your host and webmaster of the site and show MediaMonarchy.com, your source for alternative news, politics, conspiracies, cover-ups, and so very, very, very much more in the kingdom, my friends, as we now turn from the flagship site to the other sister sites in the kingdom, and we begin with the 1013 Binge and Purge on FoodWorldOrder.com with substantial progress and the lazy housekeeper. The first note again is a press release posted to MarketWatch.com. Millions of consumers are food identity theft victims. And when I saw that headline, I was like, what does that mean? And it means the identity of our food has been stolen from us, as we will see woven throughout all our stories here on Food World Order. And it reminds me, in a way, of how we'll close our Food World Order coverage. Just think of that. Millions of consumers are food identity theft victims and what that conjures up. Oklahoma steak recalled for being turkey. One of my favorite headlines of the last week. That one goes to foodsafetynews.com. We can feed 10 billion of us, a study finds, but it won't be easy. More on that from organicconsumers.org. And it's Canada's National Organic Week, October 15th through the 22nd, all next week. Eating raw fruits and vegetables may modify genetic risk for heart disease. That's from the Los Angeles Times. And again from EcoSalon, 20 unusual uses for baking soda, such as carpet deodorizer, dissolving baked on drips in the oven, acne curing face scrub, itchy insect bites, dirty dishes, deodorized sneakers, musty smells in books, spackle substitute, patio furniture, brightening your smile. Those and so many other things. You may recall a couple weeks ago, I think we covered another one from EcoSalon about unusual uses for vinegar. And I've posted both of these things because those are two things that we kind of always have in the house and aren't quite indispensable. And another thing that I have to always have a huge thanks to my girlfriend for trying to enlighten me connected to issues of the food world order. From the Montreal Gazette, Chicago community considers ban on eating while driving. And our last note, which connects in a way, and it's an update on the Buffalo, New York situation, as now substantial progress is claimed to be made on the Buffalo food truck debate.
Food truck owners and restaurant owners in Buffalo reached some kind of agreement that both sides will be happy with as far as how they run their businesses. Well, they met today. Channel 7's Kendra Eaglin was at that meeting. So do they have a deal?
Well, Keith, there's a long way to go, and that meeting just wrapped up moments ago, and we're told that substantial progress has been made. The committee hopes to iron out new details of a new resolution with a list of food truck guidelines by the end of the month. Now, the meeting was held at City Hall this afternoon. Food truck owners, as well as representatives of restaurants, were present along with their attorneys representing both sides. The restaurants support a proposal that restricts the trucks to pre-designated areas or pods. But the food truck owners argue that the pods go against their business model of being mobile. The mobile restaurants came up with a plan that allows them to operate at least 100 feet away from brick-and-mortar businesses.
100 feet away from any brick-and-mortar business, which we feel is reasonable. I mean, in places like Fort Lauderdale, for example, the limitation for food trucks is only 15 feet. In a place like New York City, it's 20 feet.
So we'd like to come up with forward-thinking legislation. And whether it's specific locations or a distance requirement still hasn't been resolved.
Now, other issues coming up at that meeting are annual licensing fees for trucks as well as other health and safety regulations. Now, the proposal supported by the food trucks calls for a $325 annual licensing fee. The committee plans to meet again early next week, and we'll have details for you then. Back to you.
So that's the situation in Buffalo, New York, and I believe we've noted here that Portland, Oregon is on the front line of the food truck essentially revolution, and other cities in the country have come to check out how they've done it here. So our related story, and just as we've seen over the last few weeks, the Occupy situation weaves throughout all our stories in some way, shape, or form. From the Boston Herald, Food Fest called off due to Occupy Boston's tent city. The sprawling Occupy Boston encampment in downtown has forced the Rose F. Kennedy Greenway Conservancy to call off a food fest long planned for this weekend. The Greenway Mobile Food Fest set for Saturday has been canceled and won't be held until the spring. The Conservancy announced, quote, Saturday's event was to include 12 mobile food vendors, many of them in large trucks. It was to take place on Dewey Square, the only parcel large enough to accommodate this type of gathering, end quote, the Conservancy said in a press release.
It's all ready to go. Food trucks ready to cook up the goods. But now a festival planned in Boston will have to wait. Occupy Boston is the reason. Fox 25's Erica Ritchie live tonight in Boston to explain. Erica?
Well, Mark, over the last 2 weeks, the protesters here have certainly gained a lot of support, but they've also been called a nuisance, and they've caused a public disturbance. Well, now they're causing an interference with pre-planned events here on the Greenway, like this weekend's Mobile Food Fest. It was scheduled for, like I said, this weekend, but now it's been bumped to the spring because of them.
775. Business is good at this cupcake truck in the city tonight. Cash is flowing as sweet tooths are satisfied.
Oh, I love that.
But back at the bakery in Somerville, owner Sarah Ross is worried. With the food truck fest canceled this weekend, her bottom line is in jeopardy.
We passed up a couple of other events in order to do this, so now we're scrambling to find a backup spot to bring the truck to.
All because of this. Occupy Boston protesters filling Dewey Square where the festival was supposed to be. Organizers said late this afternoon that combining a tent city, a dozen food trucks, and hundreds of hungry people would be a recipe for disaster and put public safety at risk.
We were kind of hoping it would be the opposite way around, that they would kick out the protesters to allow the food trucks in.
We understand people's rights to, you know, voice their opinions, so, you know, we're okay with that.
Across town at the staff meal truck, Chef Adam Gendro is not only okay with the event getting postponed,
but actually a little relieved.
Thanks so much. We appreciate that.
He says his truck's been nonstop lately and already has a regular spot to park on Saturdays, so putting the brakes on the festival won't hurt him much.
We have so many opportunities to vend in the public way that it wasn't that big a deal, so we know we'll sell the food that we prepped.
Now, you might be a little bit confused because there was just a farmer's market here yesterday and the activists didn't seem to get in the way of them, but the organizers of this weekend's event say that this was supposed to be much bigger, and so to stay on the safe side, they went ahead and postponed it. The vendors that were supposed to be here this weekend will now work with the Greenway Conservancy as they go ahead and plan the same event for sometime next year.
So we provide the link to rosekennedygreenway.org so you can read that entire press release for yourself, as the food fest has been called off due to the hashtag Occupy Boston tent city. And we have one related update posted from the Opinionator blog from Mark Bittman on the New York Times connecting food activism and Occupy Wall Street. Quoting Naomi Klein and talking about food co-ops, and so much more. Continuing on Food World Order, our latest update on the cantaloupe listeria outbreak, 116 cases and 23 deaths, as foodsafetynews.com notes that the CDC, Center for Disease Creation, said the outbreak linked to listeria-tainted cantaloupe has now killed 23 of the 116 people sickened, and that four of the illnesses are related to pregnancies, as this is now being called the deadliest listeria outbreak in 25 years.
A listeria outbreak caused by tainted cantaloupes has now been linked to at least 23 deaths. That makes it the deadliest outbreak of foodborne illness in the U.S. in more than 25 years. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says that 116 people have been sickened in the outbreak. That includes people who've died. That number may grow because symptoms of listeria can take up to 2 months to appear. The tainted cantaloupe should be off store shelves. They were traced back to a Colorado farm, which recalled them last month. The Food and Drug Administration is still investigating the cause of the outbreak. Officials are looking at the farm's water supply and say it could come from animals. Government health officials said this was the first known outbreak of listeria in cantaloupe. Listeria generally is found in processed meats and unpasteurized milk and cheese. Matt Small, The Associated Press.
Continuing on foodworldorder.com, Monsanto and the FDA fight the labeling of GMOs, as the nonprofit Center for Food Safety has petitioned the FDA to change its regulations and require all food containing genetically modified organisms to bear labels informing consumers of that fact. More on that story from singularityhub.com. As another gruesome update to stories that we have covered in the not-too-distant past on Media Monarchy, from Food Freedom, by way of Cryptagon, the no-fundamental food rights judge quits to work for a Monsanto law firm. As courts and bureaucrats continue to assert that citizens have no fundamental right to produce and consume the foods of their choice, we find Monsanto lurking nearby. That Wisconsin judge, who recently ruled that we have no right to own a cow or drink its milk, resigned to join one of Monsanto's law firms. Former judge, Patrick J. Fiedler, F-I-E-D-L-E-R, now works for Axley Brennelson, LLP, which defended Monsanto against a patent infringement case filed by an Australian firm, Genetic Technologies Limited, GTL, in early 2010. And we have more on this story with flashback to just a couple of weeks ago on foodworldorder.com with the no fundamental right. We also have the PDF of that aforementioned patent infringement case and so many other links from foodfreedom.wordpress.com, as Cryptagon notes that Fiedler should be brought up on RICO charges, racketeering and influence and corruption. Gangsters, multi-generational serial killers. From the Associated Press, government pulls back on junk food marketing proposal. Tony the Tiger and Toucan Sam can rest easy. Government officials fine-tuning guidelines for marketing food to children say they won't push the food industry to get rid of colorful cartoon characters on cereal boxes anytime soon. More on this story from businessweek.com, And the related update, again, to food freedom. Deceptive marketing exposed in a new report. Cereal crimes. How natural claims deceive consumers and undermine the organic label. A look down the cereal and granola aisle. And the photo posted up on Food Freedom. And we provide the link for you to download that entire PDF of that aforementioned report. Shows a bunch of cereals that I do know from my store. Like Kashi, which is owned by Kraft or Smucker's now. And even the Mother's Peanut Butter Bumpers. And, of course, the Whole Foods 365 cornflakes. And, no, I do not work for Whole Foods. I work at an independent Oregon-only grocery store. And some of the other good ones are Erewhon and Nature's Path. Real organic, real gluten-free. Finally, on foodworldorder.com from the New York Times, and remember, we discussed at the top of Food World Order coverage about food identity theft. Fingerprinting those seeking food stamps is denounced. Taking aim at a practice she called unnecessary, costly, and punitive, the Speaker of the City Council, Christine C. Quinn, is asking the Bloomberg administration to justify requiring applicants for food stamps to be electronically fingerprinted. New York City, where 1.8 million people receive food stamps, is one of only two jurisdictions in the country that require applicants to be fingerprinted. The other is Arizona. California and Texas recently lifted a similar requirement. New York stopped using fingerprinting for food stamp recipients statewide in 2007, but kept it in New York City at the Bloomberg administration's request. Quinn and opponents of the practice say there's no evidence that it prevents fraud and that cases of duplication could be found through other means. Instead, they say it simply deters some New Yorkers from applying for food stamps. Fingerprinting for food stamps. Food identity theft. Yes, yes, it's all a rich tapestry, isn't it? Let's shift gears now and blast off to cyberspacewar.com as we take a quick watch for a mega tsunami. Real threat or predictive programming? Is the unstable flank of the Cumbre Vieja volcano in the Canary Islands ready to plunge into the ocean? The hype is at a crescendo about an imminent mega tsunami resulting from a landslide into 4,000 feet of water. Endtimesigns.wordpress.com. The heightened concern is due to 9,300 tremors experienced in the Canary Islands since July, and that's at the extinctionprotocol.wordpress.com. A tsunami threat to the east coast of the United States is well known, as reported in a 2004 Rents article. The threat is real, but the timing seems convenient for a desperate oligarch class, perhaps? Media hype only builds the expectations of tragedy for the East Coast. As we saw, the massive hurricane, Irene, that was immediately following that bizarre earthquake. Continuing on cyberspacewar.com, moon mining, a new possibility or four-decade-old reality. Bill Penn of California reported spotting structures and cranes through a crater on a telescope. Recent reports of large titanium deposits, red areas on the moon, and that goes right to Yahoo News. Seems like a spark for the enthusiasm surrounding possible future moon mining episodes. But going to the other planet, and we mentioned red deposits, but let's go to the red planet. As the MRO, the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, mapping the Martian surface for the past 5 years, has captured images indicating water, according to an article at Mars Daily, tracing the canals of Mars. We have seen these stories before. Sometimes they have been debunked as hoaxes. But, hoax or not, we can see on so many levels, predictive programming or not, there is some kind of escalation in some type of quote-unquote disclosure. And I've always thought that Nazi Wernher von Braun at NASA is probably someone who knows what he's talking about, laid out the way disclosure would come. Amateur rocket launch on board. Camera takes you for a ride. It's another amazing amateur rocket launch that has been happening. And the link goes to the original video on YouTube. I believe we noted one of those a few weeks ago. And I think what's now made them so much more fantastic is not only that people are building rockets on their own. They've been doing that for a long, long time. But now there are cheap and amazing-looking cameras that are being mounted to them. Oh, that's what it was, 4th of July fireworks. A guy kept attaching a camera to bottle rockets and sending them up. Space junk number 3, another large satellite re-entering by the month's end. And his space junk warnings, this is becoming routine. Rosat predicted to re-enter Earth's atmosphere before the end of October, but the disclaimers flow in the Daily Mail article to hedge future liability. Quote, Professor Heiner Klinkrad of the European Space Agency assured, until now, in the more than 50 years of space history, not a single person has been killed, or rather harmed, by pieces of falling satellites. And I botched it, but did you catch the phrase, no one harmed? Lottie Williams became the first person to be hit by space junk in 1997 while she strolled in a Tulsa, Oklahoma park. A piece of superheated fuel tank insulation from a Delta II rocket struck Williams' shoulder. So the advice given to the public on this new Rosat situation, similar to the recent UARS report, 30 individual pieces that weigh 1.6 tons may survive re-entry. Odds are long of anyone being hurt, but even emergency services in Germany are practicing drills to deal with debris injuries just in case. The article points out Rosat and UARS are, quote, far smaller than the 135-ton Russian space station Mir, which fell to Earth in 2001, or the 100-ton Skylab that fell in 1979. Whew, don't you feel better? No, because there are also strong CMEs, coronal mass ejections. And are they a causal link to earthquakes and volcanoes? Something we've discussed in the past, back in January of this year on cyberspacewar.com, Earth's magnetic fields, cause of birds and fish die off. There's also a flashback to a recent episode of the Nutra Medical Report, and again, discussing the situation in the Canary Islands. Furthermore, on cyberspacewar.com, the story we covered as the third story on the latest NewWorldNextWeek.com, virus infects Creech Air Force Base systems piloting attack drones overseas. So, yes, attack drones being piloted by teenagers raised on video games are killing brown people abroad. And now we are told, or are we? Are the drones at Creech in Nevada, have they been hit with a virus or not? Originally, the story came out, and yes. Then, of course, the backup and the back down and the update. Air Force insists drone cockpit virus just a nuisance. Both the original exclusive and the back down update come from Danger Room, from Wired. And we discussed, again, remote control, Reswan, and all these amazing phony terror plots that are being ratcheted up. So what's next? Some kind of false flag operation with commandeered viral drones remote piloted by Islamic terrorists? The other note from Eric Schmidt, writing for the New York Times, in the wake of WikiLeaks, White House orders new computer security rules. And it's always a day late and a dollar short in the United States of incompetence, right? Finally, on cyberspacewar.com, we reach the 10-13 DEF CON outage, buyout, and lineup as we have an update on the, not the News Corp phone hacking story, but the celebrity nude hack story, as the FBI has made an arrest after Johansson emails hacked.
This morning, special agents with the FBI arrested a Florida man who was charged with hacking into the email accounts of dozens of people in the entertainment industry. Christopher Cheney illegally accessed these email accounts to obtain personal information about these victims, some of whom are well-known celebrities. Unfortunately, Mr. Cheney was able to access nude photos of some of the celebrities, photos that were unfortunately uploaded onto the internet. Mr. Cheney was arrested pursuant to a 26-count indictment that was returned yesterday by a federal grand jury in Los Angeles. That indictment alleges three broad classes of crimes: computer hacking, aggravated identity theft, and wiretapping. Mr. Cheney is charged with 9 counts of computer hacking for illegally gaining access to email accounts and in some cases causing damage to email systems operated by Apple and Yahoo. Once he illegally hacked into these email accounts, Mr. Cheney was able to see the emails that had been received and sent. The indictment alleges that Mr. Cheney set the victims' accounts to automatically forward all of their emails to his own email. Using these methods, Cheney stole not only private and personal photographs of the victims, he also took financial information, movie scripts, and conversations that the victims believed to be private. Based on his conduct, the indictment charges Mr. Cheney with 8 counts of aggravated identity theft for using the victim's email user IDs in furtherance of his computer hacking. Finally, Mr. Cheney is charged with 9 counts of illegal wiretapping. While many of you know that federal wiretapping laws prevent someone from listening to telephone conversations, that same statute also prohibits a person from intercepting private email communications. Because we allege in this case that Cheney had instructed the victim's email service to forward messages to him, he was able to intercept and view those very same emails, with the victims being absolutely unaware that their private communications had been compromised. If convicted, based on the 26 counts of this indictment, Mr. Cheney faces a maximum statutory penalty of 121 years in federal prison.
That is from the press conference after the FBI made the arrest of Christopher Cheney, C-H-A-N-E-Y, of the ScarJo hacking. As we continue our 1013 DEFCON on cyberspacewar.com outage, buyout, and lineup, Mitsubishi Heavy, the defense contractor portion of the Japanese automobile manufacturer, they also have been targeted by over 50 computer viruses. That's from DefenseTalk.com. Fake Netflix app poses data stealing risk. That's from PCWorld.com, and I believe that relates specifically to the Android. As BlackBerries buzz back to life after a long outage, that's from BusinessWeek.com. Dennis Ritchie, the father of the C programming language, and of course coming from the CIA-connected Bell Laboratories, has died at the age of 70. More on that from TomsHardware.com. The Microsoft Skype buyout is officially official, unfortunately, from TGDaily.com. And finally, on Cyberspace War, on this DEF CON news purge, on this Friday, October 14th, the faithful line up as Apple's new iPhone 4S hits stores Friday. Why worry about assassinating American citizens abroad? Why worry about foreclosure gate? Why worry about interconnected families seizing real assets, real resources, throwing us the crumbs and the fakes and the copies and the facsimiles? Why worry about any of that stuff when we can see Nancy Grace's nipple slip on Dancing with the Stars? We now shift gears to the most recent site in the media monarchy kingdom. It's holyhexes.com, concerning the occult and religion in society, with a piece on Pythagoras esoteric traditions and numerology, Pythagoras, known for, of course, his theorem, Pythagorean theorem, greatly influenced esoteric traditions. Even Wikipedia's entry reports, quote, Pythagoras started a secret society called the Pythagorean Brotherhood, devoted to the study of mathematics. This had a great effect on future esoteric traditions, such as Rosicrucianism and Freemasonry, both of which were occult groups dedicated to the study of mathematics, and both of which claim to have evolved out of the Pythagorean Brotherhood. Pythagorean theory was tremendously influential on later numerology. The system of numerology is a method of divination, which is also employed in the use of magic, according to the Mystica, themystica.com website. The practice is based upon statements of the Greek philosopher Pythagoras. The world is built upon the power of numbers. Continuing on holyhexes.com, you don't need to look any further than the St. John the Divine Cathedral if you're wondering what a one-world religion might look like. VigilantCitizen.com, again, does a masterful job pointing out the sites with heavy occult overtones in the Sinister Sites series. And this entry goes over the apocalyptic pillar at the St. John the Divine Cathedral in New York City. Vigilant Citizen reminds readers John the Apostle was credited with writing the Book of Revelation. The apocalyptic messages are blatant on this Gothic cathedral. Masons, the principal builders, with laying of the cornerstone on December 27, 1892, Vigilant Citizen observes, quote, the destruction of New York City, including the Twin Towers, sculpted right on the building, which we provide the photo for you, and if those aren't the Twin Towers, I don't know what they are. Strange occult symbols on the floor, weird rituals being performed in the sanctuary, home of the Temple of Understanding, which admittedly seeks to instate a one-world religion, the cathedral is definitively different. The cathedral is in fact a temple of neo-pagan, borderline satanic, the environment is more important than human life, beliefs. What kind of house of worship is this? Colonel Russell Williams and his college buddy Paul Bernardo discussed in an article from Henry Mako, Canadian serial killer linked to elite Satanists. But we'll shift gears on holyhexes.com with a piece from God Discussion. Survey says reading the Bible frequently could make you more liberal. According to Christianity Today, Lifeway Research conducted a recent poll which found that 89% of American homes own a Bible, with the average home having 4.1 Bibles. What would 1.1 of a Bible look like, by the way? But Christianity Today reports that support for capital punishment or harsh punishment for criminals decreases, and interest in social justice increases with the level of frequency the Bible is read. Again, from Christianity Today. Now, from a different site, Christian Today, out of Australia, vampire werewolf entertainment causes rise in occult activities more than just a flippant fascination. Youth today have become fixated on popular entertainment subjects like vampires, ghosts, and witches. With a link to ChristianNewsWire.com, press release discussing this same thing that we have discussed in the past on Holy Hexes and Media Monarchy, and they're taking their interests to the extreme and acting out in accordance, and we give you just the quick flashback link to just last month on Holy Hexes, as the Florida murder suspect claims she's part vampire and part werewolf. IOL.co.za, the independent online out of Zaire, notes that South African teen's evil poetry and sketches scare the family. The family of a 14-year-old girl fear she may be part of a satanic cult after finding evil drawings and poems in her school books. And a local priest warns the girl is on the brink of being lost to the devil if she hasn't already sold her soul to Satan. So, connect that in some way to this from the BBC. Dateline Kampala, Uganda, where child sacrifice is an elite business.
He did suffer brain damage. which is permanent, unfortunately.
They call him the miracle child. A machete was sliced through Alan's head and neck in an attempt to behead him. He was also castrated. The work of witch doctors, attempting child sacrifice.
You see, this is where the cut was. There's a bone missing here.
The nine-year-old's mutilated body was found just a mile from his home. It was a month before he woke from a coma. Doctors are surprised Alan survived, but he will need a lifetime of emotional and physical therapy. Child sacrifice, a juju ritual, was rare here until 3 years ago, when it re-emerged, coinciding with a boom in Uganda's economy. It's widely believed that some members of the new elite are paying witch doctors vast sums of money for an ancient practice, in the belief it'll bring them greater wealth and good health. But these people do not sacrifice their own children. In the villages that surround the capital, Kampala, I hear horrific stories.
This is where you found the body.
Tepenesi found the decapitated body of her six-year-old grandson, Stephen. He'd been missing for 24 hours. The local witch doctor admitted to sacrificing Stephen. Tepenesi told me that the police didn't want to investigate.
They offered me money to keep quiet.
She refused the offer. Uganda has a child sacrifice police task force, but families complain of corruption and slow investigations. Alan's father, Semwanga, has sold his home to pay for Alan's medical treatment and moved to the slums near the capital. They are also waiting for justice.
The men Alan claims kidnapped him for sacrifice live in this village. They were arrested and released without charge. But members of this community have told us that they continue to take children and sacrifice them.
Posing as businessmen, we asked around for a witch doctor who could bring success to our local construction project. We were introduced to this man, Awali.
We have to go inside.
During the first meeting, Awali sacrificed a goat to bring luck to the business. A few days later, we were invited back to his shrine to discuss what he regards as the most powerful spell, child sacrifice.
There are two ways of doing this. We can bury the child alive on your construction site, or we cut the child and put their blood in a bottle of spiritual medicine. If it's a male, the whole head is cut off, and his genitals. We will dig a hole at your construction site and bury the feet and the hands and put them all together in the hole.
Alan, do you recognize this man?
Awan.
And is he one of the men that took you, Alan? Yes?
Yes.
It's too dangerous to confront Awali, so we informed the police of our findings. Official police figures show 38 children have been victims of sacrifice since 2006, a number based solely on conclusive investigations. Charities complain 900 reported cases remain outstanding, including Alan's.
These children are exchanged for money. These children are slaughtered with such brutality and human circumstances.
In the last year, there have been more victims of child sacrifice from Alan's parish than the official number for the entire country. Communities like this one are backing the charity Jubilee Campaign, which is lobbying the government to regulate witch doctors and better resource the police.
The children have no voices, and their voices have been silenced by the law, by the police, which is not acting, by people who read papers and do nothing. So we have to stand whatever it takes to fight this evil.
Do you think they'll listen?
We pray that they will.
No one from the Ugandan government agreed to do an interview. The police deny inaction and corruption. Charities claim that without the full force of the law, there is little that can be done to protect Uganda's children from the witch doctors that kill for profit. And Awali, Alan's attacker, remains a free man.
And the gruesome gore grows as we approach Halloween. But finally, on HolyHexes.com, we reach the 1013 Pop A Culture News Purge with Jesus Ween Summons and Summits. Time Magazine and others are noting what they're derisively calling the latest Christian Halloween protest, calling it Jesus Ween, trying to take it back. From KIROTV.com, Seattle Satan peed on house, rang doorbell, and exposed himself. And do we have to file this as another Pacific Northwest piss story? Now, something we noted here in the last few weeks has now, of course, been mimicked at the recent GOP debate as Michelle Bachmann summons Satan during the GOP debate.
I would have to say that the 999 plan isn't a jobs plan, it is a tax plan. And I would say that from my experience being in Congress, but also as a federal tax lawyer, the last thing you would do is give Congress another pipeline of a revenue stream. And this gives Congress a pipeline and a sales tax. A sales tax can also lead to a value-added tax. The United States Congress put into place the Spanish-American War tax in 1898. We only partially repealed that in 2006. So once you get a new revenue stream, you're never going to get rid of it. And one thing I would say is when you take the 999 plan and you turn it upside down, I think the devil's in the details.
There you go. Obama hosts first evangelical summit at the White House. That, again, from GodDiscussion.com, and I'm not sure if that's the first ever or just Obama's first. Did North Korea assassinate an activist pastor? That is from BeliefNet. And yes, we are now 7 days away. We'll be here next Friday, October 21st, where Harold Camping and Family Radio have always said, October 21st would be the end of the world. Not the May date, but October. Next week, end of the world, will be here. And we close everything out on Holy Hexes and all the other sites with a piece from All Things Considered, the modern horror genre defined by the edgy realism of the 1970s.
So a few minutes ago you heard me freaking out at the haunted house, and okay, it was pretty funny. But here's something else for you. That's the scene from Alien, where the baby alien bursts out of someone's chest. Now that is true horror. Alien is one of a bunch of classic horror movies featured in a new book called Shock Value, How a Few Eccentric Outsiders Gave Us Nightmares, Conquered Hollywood, and Invented Modern Horror. Jason Zinnemann is the author, and he's at our New York Bureau. Welcome, Jason.
Great to be here.
So, Jason, your book's about the invention of modern horror. And, you know, I assume that all this stuff goes back to, you know, Boris Karloff and Nosferatu and all those classic monster films. But that's not really what you're talking about here, is it?
No, and just to some extent, I mean, you could say modern horror started with Universal Classics, or even before that, as you say, with Nosferatu. I do think there is this significant turning point starting in 1968. The movies I look at are from that period to the end of the 70s. And the reason for it is I think that the horror genre today, which is bigger than it's ever been, many, many, many of the tropes and motifs from the horror genre today come from this period. And I think it was a huge transition from the kind of old horror, Karloff and Vincent Price and a lot of these old monster movies, to the kind of new brand of scares that you saw with Rosemary's Baby and Alien and Halloween.
So I think we know what a classic horror film, you know, pre-1970s looked like. Usually there was a monster, maybe a classic Dracula or Frankenstein. There was clearly a force of evil, and then there was a force of good, and the force of evil would attack the force of good, and in the end, good would win, and in between, people maybe got scared a little bit with, like, oh, I want to suck your blood kind of thing. So what are the qualities of modern horror? What did we start to see in the late 1960s, in the 1970s that changed all that?
Well, I think a couple of things. One thing that you're putting your finger on is it became much more morally ambiguous. There was much more of a sense of confusion and disorientation. There were many more unhappy endings. It also, starting in the late 60s, partially influenced by documentary and cinema verite, it became much more realistic. Horror moved from being something very remote about a spooky house in Transylvania to about the prom queen at your, you know, in your local high school, or about going to the beach with your family.
You talk in your book quite a bit about Rosemary's Baby.
What have you done to it? What have you done to its eyes?
He has his father's eyes.
In what ways was this really sort of this icon of this new kind of horror?
Well, first of all, just the fact that a major studio was producing this pop boiler about the devil, directed by, you know, this art house filmmaker from Europe. You know, one of the real defining characteristics of horror before this period is just how disreputable it was. The other thing that I think Polanski introduced in it is this element of realism. You know, he took the supernatural story and he shot it on location in New York. He made it about things that people could relate to, the horrors of New York real estate.
Did she die in the apartment? Not that it makes
sense. No. In a hospital.
And notably about Rosemary's Baby, unlike perhaps every other monster film before that, you didn't get to see the monster, just a tiny little bit of the baby. That was supposed to be the big scare, and yet he held back for the first time.
You know, one of the interesting things about this period, I read about this in the book, I call it the monster problem, which is every horror audience wants the same thing, which is to see the monster, loosely defined. And inevitably, when you see the monster, it's kind of anticlimax. It's never as terrifying as what you could imagine. And, you know, one way to solve this problem is to keep the monster off screen for the most part.
You know, we're talking about these sort of psychological thriller, scary horror films. But at the same time, you said another revolutionary film was Night of the Living Dead. This is clearly one where the monster gets shown. In fact, many hundreds of the monsters get shown. What was Night of the Living Dead contributing to the horror genre of the time?
One element was the gore. You know, to see a little girl eat her father on screen in all its mess and blood, back then, that was something relatively new. This kind of zombie, this flesh-eating zombie, was also something new. And, you know, the fact that it had this African-American protagonist who was a hero made the movie be seen by many critics and audiences as a kind of political statement. People started to see this and say, wait a second, a horror movie doesn't just have to be cheap fun. It can also make a serious point.
So after watching all these horror films and detailing the whole history of the genre, do you have a better idea of why people like this stuff?
I have many, many theories. I think there's a nostalgic pleasure being scared because some of our most potent scares are during childhood. And I think in a time when, you know, I'm often on my BlackBerry worried about three things that I have to do the next day and something I said the day before, I never feel more in the present than I'm when I'm scared at a horror film. And I think that is a very addictive feeling.
Well, those are all good brainy explanations, but maybe you're just a sicko.
Well, I would say that's also a big part of it.
That's Jason Zinnemann. His new book is Shock Value: How a Few Eccentric Outsiders Gave Us Nightmares, Conquered Hollywood, and Invented Modern Horror.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Shock Value, Sinister Forces, and Future Crimes. That's the way this episode 235 is going to close, my friends, as we wrap up our related business. I've been getting very behind on some of the listener mail and correspondence, and perhaps I'll take a segment next week to kind of go over some of the comments, some of the things brought up, and even some of the music and some of the videos and other ideas and suggestions that other folks have brought up. You may recall last week's episode we heard music from the Dum Dum Girls, which I went to go see last Friday night. And we also heard music from The Drums, who I also went to go see this past Monday night and even got to meet them and chat with them a little bit after the show, got a record signed. And speaking of listener mail, I got an email from Steve in Vancouver that said he went to go see The Drums the next night after I saw them. Fantastic. Tonight, comedian Doug Stanhope is in town, and you may recall hearing him on our recent 4th of July mixtape episode discussing nationalism at the very beginning. And if I go to that show tonight, I believe that'd be three shows in 1 week and probably more concerts than I've ever seen in any one small stretch of time in my life. But of course, that comes after wrapping up episode 235 and putting it out for all the folks out there in the world, wherever you are, however you receive this transmission. I appreciate it. I appreciate you spending your time with me. And we're going to close this episode again with Future Crimes. We open the show with Romance, lead single from the debut self-titled album From Wild Flag, featuring two members of Slater Kinney, who I've met at my store here in Portland, Oregon. We're going to hear the track Future Crimes here at the end of episode 235 for October 14th, 2011, as we glance at some of the last bit of breaking news. New York police arrest 14 Wall Street protesters in Lower Manhattan clash. U.S. candidate Romney among fundraising leaders. Former Iran assassin says alleged plot makes no sense. And Obama orders U.S. troops to help chase down African army leader. Obama sending troops to Africa to help fight guerrilla group. My name is James Evan Pilato, your host and webmaster of the site and show MediaMonarchy.com, reminding you, as always, my friends, don't hate the media, become the media. Take care.
MediaMonarchy.com is your source for alternative news, politics, conspiracies, and cover-ups. Featuring weekly radio shows on the Portland Radio Authority, PRAradio.org, the New World Next Week video series with CorbettReport.com, plus special interview episodes, B-sides, mixtapes, and so much more. Send news tips to MediaMonarchy@gmail.com. You can make a donation, or mail Media to the Monarchy, at P.O. Box 12165, Portland, Oregon 97212. Thanks to all the internet and community radio stations who broadcast these shows, and most of all, thanks to you. Remember, don't hate the media, become the media.
Whether you went on with the diary, or whether you did not cooperate, made no difference. The thought police would get him just the same.